The Hermit by Tuesday Love Sang Rampa, read for you by Blue Friend in beautiful BC. Chapter 3. For some time the young monk sat on the ground, cradling the sick man's head and trying to feed him small amounts of sampa. At last he stood up and said, "I shall have to carry you to the cave of the hermit." So saying, he lifted up the man and managed to get him over one shoulder, face down, and folded like a rolled-up blanket. Staggering under the weight, he made his way out of the little grove of trees and set out upon the stony path to the cave. At last, after what seemed to be an endless journey, he reached the fireside. Gently, he allowed the man to slide to the ground. "Venerable one," he said, "I found this man in a thicket beside the lake. He had a kang around his neck, and he's very sick. I removed the kang and have brought him here." With a branch, the young monk stirred the fire so that sparks rose up and the air was filled with the pleasant scent of burning wood. Pausing only to pile on more wood, he turned back to the old hermit. "The kang, eh?" said the latter. "That means he is a convict. But what is a convict doing here? No matter what he has done, if he's sick, we must do what we can. Perhaps the man can speak." "Yes, venerable one," muttered the man in a weak voice. "I am too far gone to be helped physically. I need help spiritually so that I may die in peace. May I talk to you?" "Most certainly," replied the old hermit. "Speak, and we will listen." The sick man moistened his lips with water passed to him by the young monk, cleared his throat, and said, "I was a successful silversmith in the city of Lhasa. Business was good. Even from the lamasaries came work. Then, oh, blight of blights, Indian traders came and made available cheap goods from the bazaars of India, things they called mass-produced, inferior, shoddy, stuff I would not touch. My business fell off. Money became short. My wife could not face adversity, so she went to the bed of another, to the bed of a rich trader who had coveted her before I married her, a trader who as yet was not touched by the Indian competitors. I had no one to help me, no one to care, and no one for whom I could care." He stopped, overcome by his bitter thoughts. The old hermit and the young monk kept silent, waiting for him to recover. At last he continued, "Competition increased. There came a man from China, bringing even cheaper goods by the yak load. My business ceased. I had nothing but my meager supplies, which no one wanted. At last an Indian trader came to me and offered an insultingly low price for my home and all that was in it. I refused, and he jeered at me, saying that soon he would have it for nothing. Being hungry and sick at heart, I lost my temper and threw him out of my house. He landed on his head in the roadway and cracked his temple on a chance stone." Again the sick man stopped, overcome by his thoughts. Again, the others kept silent while they waited for him to continue. "I was surrounded by throngs," he went on, "some blaming me and some speaking out in favor. Soon I was dragged before a magistrate and the tale was told. Some spoke to the magistrate for me, some spoke against me. He deliberated but a short time before sentencing me to wear the kang for a year. The device was fetched and locked around my neck. With it on, I couldn't feed myself nor give myself drink, but was always dependent upon what others offered me. I could not work, and I had to wander begging for not merely food, but someone to feed me. I couldn't lay down. I had always to stand or to sit. He turned even paler and appeared to be at the point of collapse. The young monk said, "Venerable one, I found a container at the site of the trader camp. I will fetch it and then can make tea." Rising to his feet, he hurried off down the path to where he had left the container, the spike, and the kang. Casting about and delving into the undergrowth springing up around the former camp, he found a hook that evidently belonged to the container. Filling the container with water, after scrubbing it with sand, he set off back along the path, carrying the can of water, hook, spike, and kang. Soon he was back and with great glee tossed the heavy kang straight on the fire. Sparks shot up and the clouds of smoke billowed out, while from the neck hole in the center of the kang a solid column of flame funneled out. The young monk rushed into the cave and brought out the bundles given him by the trader so recently. Brick tea, a large and very solid cake of yak butter, dusty, quite a bit rancid, but still recognizable as butter. A rare treat, a small sack of brown sugar. Outside, by the fire, he carefully slid a smooth stick through the handle of the can and placed it in the center of the bright fire. Sliding out the stick, he placed it carefully to one side. The tea brick was already broken in places, so he selected some of the smaller lumps and dropped them in the water, which was now beginning to get hot. A quarter of the hard butter was hacked off with the aid of a sharp flat stone. Into the now bubbling water it went, to melt and spread a thick yellow film over the surface. A small lump of borax, part of a larger lump in the tea bag, went next in order to improve the flavor, and then, oh, wonderful treat, a whole handful of brown sugar. Seizing a freshly peeled stick, the young monk stirred the mass vigorously. Now the whole surface was obscured by steam, so he slid the stick under the handle and lifted out the can. The old hermit had been following the proceedings with great interest. By sounds, he had been alert to each stage of the matter. Now, without being asked, he held out his bowl. The young monk took it and, skimming the scum of dirt, sticks, and froth from the concoction, half filled the old man's bowl before carefully returning it to him. The convict whispered that he had a bowl in his rags. Bringing it out, he was offered a full bowl of tea in the knowledge that he, having sight, would not spill any. The young monk filled his own bowl and sank back to drink it with a sigh of satisfaction that comes to those who have worked hard for anything. For a time, all was quiet as each sat engrossed in his own thoughts. From time to time the young monk rose to fill the bowls of his companions, or his own. The evening grew dark. A chill wind sighed through the trees, making leaves whisper in protest. The waters of the lake grew, rippled, and waves soughed and sighed among the pebbles of the foreshore. Gently, the young monk took the old hermit by the hand and led him back into the now dark interior of the cave, then returned for the sick man. He roused from his sleep as the young monk lifted him. "I must talk," he said, "for there is little life left within me." The young monk carried him inside the cave and scooped a depression for his hip bone and made a mound for his head. A journey outside to heap sandy soil around the fire to damp it down and keep it a smolder throughout the night. By the morrow, the ashes would still be red, and it would be easy to rekindle into vigorous flame. With the three men, one ancient, one middle-aged, and one just approaching manhood, sitting or lying close together, the convict spoke again. "My time grows short," he said. "I feel that my ancestors are ready to greet me and welcome me home. For a year I have suffered and starved. For a year I have wandered from Lhasa to Fari and back, seeking food, seeking aid, seeking. I've seen great lamas who spurned me and others who were kind. I have seen the lowly give to me when they had to go hungry for it. For a year I have wandered, even as the most lowly nomad. I have fought with dogs for their scraps, and then found I could not reach my mouth." He stopped and took a drink of the cold tea which stood beside him, now thick with congealed butter. "But how did you reach us?" asked the old hermit in his quavery voice. "I bent to the water at the very far end of the lake to drink, and a kang overbalanced me so that I fell in. A strong wind blew me far across the water so that I saw the night and the day and the night which followed and the day after. Birds perched upon the kang and tried to peck my eyes, but I shouted and frightened them off. Still, I drifted at a fast rate until I lost consciousness and knew no more how long I drifted. Earlier today, my feet touched the bottom of the lake and roused me. Overhead, a vulture was circling. So I struggled and crawled ashore to fall head first into the thicket where the young father found me. I am overtaxed, my strength is gone, and soon I shall be in the heavenly fields." "Rest for the night," said the old hermit. "The spirits of the night are astir. We must do our astral journeys ere it be too late." With the aid of his stout staff, he climbed to his feet and hobbled to the inner portion of the cave. The young monk gave a little sampa to the sick man, settled him more comfortably, and then lay down to think over the events of the day and so to fall asleep. The moon rose to her full height and majestically moved to the other side of the sky. The noises of the night changed from hour to hour. Here insects droned and whirred, while from afar came the frightened shriek of a night bird. The mountain range crackled as the rocks cooled and contracted in the night air. Nearby, a rock well lent thunder to the night as rocks and mountain debris came tumbling down to pound a tattoo on the hard-packed earth. A night rodent called urgently to its mate, and unknown things rustled and murmured in the whispering sands. Gradually the stars paled, and the first shafts heralding a new day shot across the sky. Suddenly, as though electrified, the young monk sat bolt upright. Wide awake he sat, staring vainly, trying to pierce the intense darkness of the cave. Holding his breath, he concentrated on listening. No robbers would come here, he thought. Everyone knew that the old hermit had nothing. The old hermit, was he ill? The young monk wondered. Rising to his feet, he felt a cautious way to the end of the cave. "Venerable one, are you all right?" he called. The sounds of the old man staring. "Yes, it is our guest, maybe." The young monk felt foolish, having completely forgotten about the convict. Turning, he hurried to where the entrance of the cave showed as a dim gray blur. Yes, the well-protected fire was still alive. Grasping a stick, the young monk thrust it into the heart of the red and blew steadily. Flame appeared and he piled more sticks upon the awakening blaze. By now, the first stick was well alight at the end. Seizing it, he turned and hurried into the cave. The burning brand sent weird shadows dancing crazily on the walls. The young man jumped as a figure loomed into the feeble torchlight. It was the old hermit. At the young monk's feet, the convict lay huddled, legs drawn up to his chest. The torch reflected in his wide open eyes, giving them the impression of winking. The mouth drooped open and a thin line of dried blood wandered from the corners down his cheeks and formed a turgid pool by his ears. Suddenly there came a rattling gurgle and the body twitched spasmodically, heaved up into a taut bow, and relaxed with the violent and final exhalation of breath. The body creaked and there was the gurgle of fluids. The limbs became limp and the features flaccid. The old hermit and the young monk together intoned the service for the release of departing spirits and gave telepathic instructions for his passage to the heavenly fields. Outside the cave, the light became brighter. Birds began to sing as a fresh day was born, but here there was death. "You will have to remove the body," said the old hermit. "You must dismember it and remove the entrails so that the vultures can ensure a proper air burial." "We have no knife, venerable one," protested the young monk. "I have a knife," replied the hermit. "I am keeping it that my own death may be properly conducted. Here it is. Do your duty and return the knife to me." Reluctantly, the young man picked up the dead body and carried it out of the cave. Near the rockfall, there was a large flat slab of stone. With much effort, he lifted the body onto the level surface and removed the soiled and tattered rags. High overhead, there sounded the beating of heavy wings. The first vultures had appeared at the odor of death. Shuddering, the young monk plunged the point of the knife into the thin abdomen and drew it down. From the gaping wound, the intestines came bulging out. Quickly, he grasped the slimy coils and pulled them out. On the rock, he spread the heart, liver, kidneys, and stomach. Hacking and twisting, he cut off the arms and legs. With naked body covered with blood, he hurried from the dreadful scene and rushed to the lake. Into the water he rushed and scrubbed himself with handfuls of fine wet sand. Carefully he washed the old hermit's knife and scoured it with clean sand. Now he was shivering with cold and shock. The wind blew icy upon his nude body. The water trickling down felt almost as though the fingers of death were drawing lines upon his shuddering skin. Quickly he leapt out of the water and shook himself like a dog. Running, he drove a little warmth back into his body. By the cave mouth he picked up and donned his robe, previously discarded so that it would not be soiled by contact with the dismembered dead. Just as he was about to enter the cave, he remembered his task was not completed. Slowly, he retraced his steps to the stone where vultures still fought over the choicest morsels. The young man was amazed at how little was left of the body. Some vultures sat contentedly on nearby rocks and placidly preened their feathers. Others pecked hopefully among the exposed ribs of the corpse. Already they had removed all the skin from the head, leaving the skull bare. Picking up a heavy rock, the young man brought it down with shattering force on the skeletal skull, cracking it like an eggshell, and, as intended, exposing the brains for the ever-hungry vultures. Then, grabbing the rags and the bowl of the dead man, he rushed back to the fire and tossed rags and bowl into the blazing center. To one side, still red-hot, there lay the metal parts of the Kang, the only remnants of what had once been a wealthy craftsman with a wife, houses, and high skills. Pondering the matter, the young monk turned about and entered the cave. The old hermit was sitting in meditation, but roused as his junior approached. "Man is temporary, man is frail," he said. "Life on earth is but illusion, and the greater reality lies beyond. We will break our fast and then continue the transfer of knowledge, for until I have told you all, I cannot leave my body, and I then want you to do for me what you have just done for our friend the convict. Now let us eat, for we must maintain our strength as best we can. Do you fetch water and heat it? Now, with my end so near, I can afford to indulge my body to that small extent." The young monk picked up the can and walked out of the cave, down to the lakeside, fastidiously avoiding the place where he had washed off the dead man's blood. Carefully, he scoured the can inside and out. Carefully, he scoured the old hermit's bowl, as well as his own. Filling the can with water, he carried it with his left hand and dragged along a very substantial branch with his right. A solitary vulture came swooping down to see what was happening. Landing heavily, it hopped a few steps, then flapped into the air again with a shriek of anger at having been fooled. Further up to the left, an overgorged vulture was vainly trying to get into the air. It ran, leaped, and energetically beat the air with flailing wings, but it had eaten too much. Finally giving up, it tucked its head beneath a wing in shame and went to sleep while waiting for nature to reduce its weight. The young monk chuckled to think that even vultures could eat too much, and he wondered wistfully what it would be like to even have the opportunity of eating too much. He had never had enough, like most monks. He always felt hungry to some degree. But the tea had to be made. Time did not stand still. Putting the can in the fire to heat the water, he passed into the cave to get the tea, the butter, borax, and sugar. The old hermit sat waiting expectantly. But one cannot sit drinking tea for too long when the fires of life are burning low, and when an aged man's vitality slowly ebbs. Soon the old hermit settled himself anew, and while the young monk was tending the fire, the old one's precious fire, after more than 60 years without, years of cold, years of utter self-denial, years of hunger and privation, which only death could end. Years when the otherwise complete futility of existence as a hermit was softened by the knowledge that there was, after all, a task. The young monk came back into the cave, smelling of fresh wood smoke. Quickly he seated himself before his senior. In that far-off place so long ago, I was resting on the strange metal platform. The man, my captor, was making clear to me that I was there not for my pleasure, but for theirs, to be a repository of knowledge, said the old man. I said, but how can I take an intelligent interest if I am merely held captive, an unwilling, uncooperative captive, who has not the vaguest idea of what it is all about or where he is? How can I take an interest when you regard me as less than dust? I have been handled worse than we handle a dead body, which is to be fed to vultures. We show respect to the dead and to the living, but you treat me as excreta, which has to be thrown on a field with as little ceremony as possible, and yet you claim to be civilized, whatever that means. The man was obviously shaken and not a little impressed by my outburst. I heard him pacing the room. Forward, a scrape of feet as he turned around, backwards and then forwards again. Suddenly he stopped beside me and said, I will consult my superior. Rapidly he moved away and obviously picked up some hard object. It went whirr, 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 and then hurr, hurr. A sharp metallic click and a staccato sound came from it. Speech, I judged. The man with me spoke at length, making the same sort of peculiar sounds. Clearly there was a discussion which went on for some few minutes. Click, clang, came from the machine, and the man came back to me. First, I am going to show you this room, he said. I am going to tell you about us, what we are, what we're doing, and I am going to attempt to enlist your aid by understanding. First, here is sight. Light came to me. Sight came to me. A most peculiar sight, too. I was looking up at the underside of the man's chin, looking up his nostrils. The sight of the hairs in the nostrils amused me greatly for some reason, and I began to laugh. He bent down, and one of his eyes filled the whole of my vision. Oh, he exclaimed, someone has tipped up the box. The world whirled around me. My stomach churned, and I felt nausea and vertigo. Oh, sorry, said the man. I should have switched off before rotating the box. Never mind, you'll feel better in a moment. These things happen. Now I could see myself. A horrid experience it was to see my body lying so pale and wan and with so many tubes and attachments coming from it. It was a shock indeed to see myself and see that my eyelids were tight closed. I was lying on what appeared to be a thin sheet of metal, supported on just one pillar. Attached to the pillar foot were a number of pedals, while standing by me was a rod which held glass bottles filled with colorful fluids. These were, in some way, connected to me. The man said, "You are on an operating table. With these pedals," he touched them, "we can put you in any desired position." He stepped on one and the table swung around. He touched another and the table tilted until I feared that it might fall. Another and the table rose until I could see right under it. A most uncanny experience, which caused the strangest sensations in my stomach. The walls, obviously, were of metal, of a most pleasant green color. Never before had I seen such fine material, smooth, without blemish, and clearly some special form of joining must have been employed, for there was no sign even of where walls, floor, and ceiling ended or commenced. The walls flowed, as one might say, into the floor or into the ceiling. No sharp corners, not even a single sharp edge. Then a section of the wall slid aside with that metallic rumble I had come to know. A strange head poked through, looked around briefly, and as abruptly withdrew. The wall slid shut. On the wall in front of me, there was an array of little windows, some of them about the size of a large man's palm. Behind them, pointers stood at certain red or black marks. Some large rectangular windows attracted my interest. An almost mystical blue glow emanated from them. Strange spots of light jiggled and danced in some incomprehensible pattern, while at yet another window, a brown red line wavered up and down in strange rhythmical forms, almost like the dance of a serpent, I thought. The man, I will call him my captor, smiled at my interest. "All these instruments indicate you," he said, "and here are indicated 9 waves from your brain. 9 separate sine waves, with the output from your brain electricity superimposed upon them. They show you are of superior mentality. They show you have truly remarkable ability to memorize, hence your suitability for this task." Very gently turning the side box, he pointed to some strange glassware, which previously had been beyond my range of vision. "These," he explained, "continually feed you through your veins and drain off waste from your blood. These others drain off other waste products from your body. We are now in the process of improving your general health so that you will be fit enough to withstand the undeniable shock of all that we are going to show you. Shock there will be, because no matter that you consider yourself to be an educated priest, compared to us, you are the lowest and most ignorant savage. And what to us is commonplace, to you it will be miracles beyond belief almost. And a first introduction to our science causes severe psychic shock. Yet this must be risked, and there is risk, although we make every effort to minimize it." He laughed and said, In your temple services, you make much ado about the sounds of the body. Oh, yes, I know all about your services. But have you really heard how the body sounds? Listen. Turning, he moved to the wall and pressed a shining white knob. Immediately, from a lot of small holes, came sounds which I recognized as the body sounds. Smiling, he twisted another knob, and the sounds increased and filled the whole room. Throb, throb went the heart sounds, in such volume that the glassware behind me rattled in sympathy. A touch of the knob again, and the heart sounds went, and there came the gurgle of fluids in the body, but as loud as a mountain stream rushing across a stony bed in its anxiety to get to the sea so very far away. There came the sigh of gases, like a storm, rushing through leaves and branches of mighty trees, plops and splashes as though great boulders were being toppled into some very deep lake. Your body, he said, your body sounds. We know everything about your body. But, unhonored captor, I said, this is no marvel, this is no miracle. We poor, ignorant savages here in Tibet can do as well as that. We too can magnify sound. Not so vastly, agreed, but we can still do it. We can also release the soul from the body and bring it back. Can you? He looked at me with a quizzical expression on his face. You do not scare easily, eh? You think of us as enemies, as captors, eh? Sir, I replied, you have shown me no friendship yet. You have shown me no reason why I should trust you or cooperate with you. You keep me a paralyzed captive, as some wasps keep their captives. There are those among you who appear to be devils. We have pictures of such, and we revile them as nightmare creatures from some hellish world. Yet here they are consorts of yours. Appearances can be misleading, he replied. Some of these are the kindest of people. Others with saintly mien would stoop to any low act that occurred to their perverted minds. Yet you, like all savage people, are led astray by the outward appearances of a person. Sir, was my response, I have yet to decide upon which side your interests lie, good or evil. If they be good and I be convinced, then and only then will I cooperate. Otherwise, I will use any means I can to circumvent your aims, no matter what cost to me. But surely, was his somewhat cross rejoinder, you will agree that we saved your life when you were starving and ill? I put on my gloomiest expression as I answered, saved my life? For what? I was on my way to the heavenly fields. You dragged me back. Nothing you can do now will be so unkind. What is life to a blind man? How can one who is blind study? Food, how shall I get food now? No, there was no kindness in prolonging my life. You even stated before that I am not here for my pleasure, but for your purpose. Where is the kindness in that? You have trussed me up here, and I have been the sport of your females? Good. Where is all this good you mention? He stood looking at me, hands on his hips. Yes, he said at last, from your point, we haven't been kind, have we? Perhaps I can convince you, though, and then you will be useful indeed. He turned and walked to the wall. This time I saw what he did. He stood facing a square filled with small holes and then pushed a black dot. A light shone above the whole square and grew into a luminous mist. There, to my stupefaction, a face and a head formed in living colors. My captor spoke at length in that strange, outlandish tongue, and then stopped. To my petrified amazement, the head swiveled in my direction, and bushy eyebrows were raised. Then a small, grim smile appeared at the corners of the mouth. There was a barked, terse sentence, and the light faded. The mist swirled and seemed to be sucked into the wall. My captor turned to me with every sign of satisfaction on his face. "Right, my friend," he said. "You have proved that you are a very strong character, a very tough man with whom to deal. Now I have permission to show you that which no other member of your world has seen." He turned to the wall again and stabbed the black spot. The mist formed again, with this time the head of a young female. My captor spoke to her, obviously giving orders. She nodded her head, stared curiously in my direction, and faded away. "Now, we will have to wait a few moments," said my captor. "I'm having a special device brought in, and I'm going to show you places on your world, cities of the world. Have you any choice where you would like to see?" "I have no knowledge of the world," I replied. "I have not traveled." "Yes, but surely you've heard of some city," he expostulated. "Well, yes, I've heard of Kalimpong." "Kalimpong, eh? A small Indian border settlement. Can't you think of some better place? How about Berlin, London, Paris, Cairo? Surely you want to see something better than Kalimpong." "But, sir," I replied, "I have no interest in those places you've mentioned. The names convey nothing to me, except that I've heard traders discuss such places. But it means nothing to me. I'm not interested. Nor, if I saw pictures of these places, could I say if it were true or not. If this wonderful contraption of yours can do what you say it can, then show me Lhasa, show me Faree, show me the Western Gate, the Cathedral, the Patala. I know those, and will be aware if your device is true or some clever trick." He looked at me with the most peculiar expression on his face. He appeared to be in a state of stupefaction. Then he pulled himself together with a visible jerk and exclaimed, "Taught my business by an unlettered savage, eh? And the fellow is right, too. There is something in this native cunning, after all. Of course he has to have a frame of reference, otherwise he will not be impressed at all. Well, well." The sliding panel was abruptly jerked aside, and four men appeared, guiding a very large box, which seemed to be floating on air. The box must have been of considerable weight, because although it appeared to float without weight, it took much effort to start it moving, or to change its direction, or to stop it. Gradually, the box was edged into the room where I lay. For a time, I was fearful that they were going to upset my table as they pushed and pulled. One man bumped into the eye box, and the resulting gyrations left me for a time sick and dizzy. But at last, after much discussion, the box was placed against the wall, directly in line with my sight. Three of the men withdrew and shut the panel behind them. The fourth man and my captor engaged in animated discussion with much waving of hands and gesticulations. At last my captor turned to me and said, "He says that we cannot bring in Lhasa because it is too close. We have to be further away so that we can focus." I said nothing, took no notice at all, and after a short wait my captor said, "Would you like to see Berlin, Bombay, Calcutta?" My reply was, "No, I would not. They're too far away for me." He turned back to the other man, and a quite acrimonious argument followed. The other man looked as if he wanted to weep. He waved his hands in utter frustration and in desperation, dropped to his knees in front of the box. The front slid off, and I saw what appeared to be just a large window and nothing more. Then the man took some bits of metal from his clothing and crawled to the back of the strange box. Strange lights shone in the window. Swirls of meaningless colors formed. The picture wavered, flowed, and eddied. There was an instant when shadows formed which might have been the patella, but again it might equally have been smoke. The man crawled out from the rear of the box, mumbled something, and hurried from the room. My captor, looking very displeased, said, "We are so close to Lhasa that we cannot focus. It's like trying to see through a telescope when one is closer than that instrument will focus. It works well at a distance, but close up, no telescope will focus. We have the same trouble here. Is that clear to you?" "Sir," I replied, "you talk of things I don't understand. What is this telescope you mention? I've never seen one. You say that Lhasa is too close. I say it's a very long walk for a very long time. How can it be too close?" An agonized expression shone on my captor's face. He clutched his hair, and for a moment I thought he'd dance on the floor. Then he calmed himself with an effort and said, "When you had your eyes, did you ever bring something so close that your eyes could not focus? That is what I mean. We cannot focus at this short range." End of chapter 3.